From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. For the first time in, let's see, 35 years, there is real movement towards a federal shield law that would allow reporters to protect their anonymous sources. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi reportedly will bring a bill that passed in committee last summer to the floor as early as Tuesday. And recently, the Senate Judiciary Committee passed a similar bill. Journalists already have a legal right to protect their sources in most states, but as Adam Liptak of the New York Times explains, if Congress does craft a true national shield law, reporters will finally have won the privilege to protect sources in federal cases, as some other professionals do.
Those privileges, priests, lawyers, doctors, psychotherapists, are quite well established and fairly strict. Although they do have exceptions often. In the case of lawyers, it has an exception for crimes and frauds. And if you were to apply some of those exceptions to journalists, you might have real problems because very often the people who speak to us and whom we want to protect are violating a law by providing information to us.
But certainly journalists aren't calling for a blanket exemption from all legal proceedings always forever.
Not anymore. The press used to take a quite absolutist stand. In 1972, when the Supreme Court heard its only case on this subject, many news organizations said that only absolute protection will do. That's not the way we talk anymore.
The 1972 case you refer to as Brandsburg v. Hayes, it found that reporters have no First Amendment right to protect their sources. Now, recently you ran across some notes written by Justice Lewis Powell at the time. He's known for having written an ambiguous concurring opinion that is often used to argue that reporters, maybe because it's so vague, do in fact have a constitutional right to protect their sources.
These notes that just surfaced actually really clarify what Justice Powell meant to say. On the one hand, he says that the First Amendment, the Constitution, does not contain a reporter's privilege. But, he says, there's absolutely nothing wrong with judges, just as they have created lawyer-client and doctor-patient privileges, nothing wrong with them taking account of the special status that journalists have and the special role they play in balancing the interest in the free flow of information against the interest of getting every person's evidence into court. And I should emphasize, these notes have no legal force. No one can wave this around in court and say, I win. But they do clarify and in a funny way anticipate where the law would find itself going 35 years later.
Thursday before last, the Senate Judiciary Committee passed a version of a national shield law. It's drawn mixed reviews. What do you think is the best thing about it? What do you think is the worst thing about it?
The best thing about it is that it exists. When you get a subpoena, you want to be able to go to court and start arguing. And today in federal court, very often the answer to an attempt to get rid of a subpoena is, sorry, you guys have no rights. So if all this does is start a conversation in front of a judge who will hear from journalists and balance the relevant interests, that's a big positive. On the other hand, the bill is weak, and a lot of journalists are supporting it but holding their noses. This is by far weaker than any of the state shield laws. It's much weaker even than the Justice Department's own guidelines.
But you think the Senate came to a pretty smart conclusion when it came to actually defining who a journalist is?
Right. It says that a journalist is someone who gathers and disseminates information of public interest on a regular basis. And if you do that, it doesn't matter if you're a blogger or a TV broadcaster or a newspaper reporter.
There are a lot of people out there, and they aren't just in Congress or in the White House, who think that reporters have been engaged in an awful lot of special pleading lately.
You know, Brooke, if you think back at some of the greatest journalistic triumphs of the past couple years, the Times is reporting on the NSA surveillance program, the Washington Post reporting on secret prisons, that reporting could not have been done without confidential sources. And I don't think any serious person disputes that those are incredibly important issues to bring forward for candid debate.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Adam Liptak is the national legal correspondent for the New York Times.
Last summer, residents of Cape Coral, Florida, got some unwelcome news. The assessments for a new water and sewer system were rising from $12,000 per home to, in some cases, $40,000. The local Fort Myers News Press, of course, jumped on the story. But here's the twist. The paper didn't just deploy a few reporters. Online and in the print editions, it also asked readers to get involved. Within hours, says executive editor Kate Merrymont, information came pouring in, from assessment letters to blueprint analysis to you name it.
6,500 different individuals in the community contributed information. On the second day of this project, we got an email from someone several states away who saw it on our website and said, "Did you know that an audit had been done and not released? Would you like a copy?"
Why, yes, thank you. They posted the audit, whereupon all hell broke loose immediately and pretty much ever since. It's an ongoing investigative story, a collaboration between the professionals at the paper and citizen deputies, documenting, so far, pending official investigations of malfeasance or worse, lack of oversight on a grand scale. It was also a textbook example of journalistic crowdsourcing to produce a story the news press could never have gathered alone.
We would have gotten pieces of it. I don't think we would have gotten all of it. We can't be in every neighborhood. We can't have access to every document.
With the rise of the internet and the precipitous decline of the traditional newspaper business, variations of crowdsourcing, standing alone or in symbiosis with traditional news outlets, are widely seen as the future of journalism. At a summit this week at the City University of New York, participants considered examples as ambitious as the Cape Coral Project and as rudimentary as Topics.com, which aggregates local news stories for every individual zip code in the country and solicits comments from the locals. Founder and CEO Chris Tolles typed in the zip for Natchitoches, Louisiana.
They're talking about a lot of stuff. There was a murder case that there's 2,000 comments on. There's a comment about the Natchitoches Council introducing a sagging pants law that's got 100 comments. There are comments about politicians. So it's kind of interesting, but it looks like an active forum in a little town that evidently was not getting covered prior to us being around.
That's nice, but one worry is that active citizens don't necessarily act appropriately. Some of the commentary on Topics, for instance, is a little on the libelous side. In Cape Coral, Kate Merrymont had to rein in some overzealous citizen muckrakers who sometimes overplayed their tenuous connection to the news press. And then there's just supply and demand. Robin Hammond, a senior producer for the BBC, says that when the call goes out, the ensuing flood of material not only overwhelms his staff, but leaves contributors disappointed when their contributions don't lead the evening news. The BBC has now learned, he says, to be extremely specific.
So that people don't have the expectation that by sending a photograph of a fluffy kitten playing with a ball of yarn, when what we really want is a fuel depot exploding, they don't have that expectation that we're going to use the stuff that they send in.
Yeah, it seems blindingly obvious, yet that failure to finely calibrate expectations along the lines of remove child before folding stroller helped sink the highest profile experiment in journalistic crowdsourcing. That was Assignment Zero, the much heralded brainchild of NYU professor and blogger Jay Rosen. The project began auspiciously with participants quickly conducting interviews with 70 sources. Then, quickly, everything unraveled.
What went wrong? Well, we kind of thought that if we divided our big trend story up into smaller sections and told people that they could contribute knowledge to those smaller stories, that they would kind of self-organize and figure out how to do it. But they didn't, and nothing happened, and our scheme fell apart.
Rosen also believes that the nature of the story, which happened also to be about crowdsourcing, didn't lend itself to narrow divisions of labor. Compare that to the initiative by the Brian Lehrer Show on our very own WNYC radio in New York. Here's Brian 2 weeks ago deputizing his listeners.
Price disparities of common food items in the New York area. The assignment is this. Go to your local grocery store, any local grocery store, and just check out the price of three goods, milk, lettuce, and beer. We'll tell you exactly what kind in a minute. Once you have the prices, just go to our website and report your findings. in our special comments page for that. Pretty simple, right?
That is, as far as I'm concerned, the future of crowdsourced journalism.
Wired magazine writer Jeff Howe, who coined the term crowdsourcing.
They don't want to write a big feature on a change in the zoning law any more than they want to go back and rewrite the term paper they got a D on in college. But what they will do is they'll say, huh, man, I want to know if I'm paying too much for a head of iceberg lettuce.
And they want to know if the White House has strong-armed the Justice Department into firing politically wayward U.S. attorneys. That's how Josh Marshall of the blog Talking Points Memo enticed his readers to sift through more than 20,000 emails in search of treachery. It was a breathtaking display of the crowd completing in days what even a team of staff reporters might not finish for months. It was also an extremely rare example of citizen journalism not tied to an existing traditional news organization. At Wednesday's summit, the conspicuous focus was on the hybrid or pro-am approach to crowdsourced journalism, because everybody understood that standalone enterprises lack resources for hiring, organizing, editing, and lawyering even unpaid volunteers. Mark Potts is a consultant and founder of the defunct hyperlocal network, Backfence.com.
The elephant in the room is there's not a business model. We're still sort of in the let's put on a show stage of user-generated hyperlocal citizens journalism. Hey, kids, let's put on a show. I've got Mickey. I've got Judy. You've got to find a way to make a business out of it if you're going to sustain it. Otherwise, it's a hobby.
Potts's blunt assessment was a bit of a buzzkill Wednesday, but hardly news to the event's organizer, City University journalism professor Jeff Jarvis, whose blog BuzzMachine.com is an ongoing brainstorming session on media economics. Jarvis sees the elephant in the room all right, but that's not all he sees.
And I have no sense that we're anywhere near a solution, but we damn well better be experimenting.
Because the mainstream media, on which we still depend for news and information and government watchdogging, is not an elephant. It's looking more and more like a woolly mammoth, stumbling inexorably toward extinction.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Early this summer, journalist Chauncey Bailey was murdered. The editor of the African-American weekly Oakland Post had been investigating the finances of Your Black Muslim Bakery, a local business with alleged criminal dealings, including violence. A handyman at the bakery has since been charged with the murder, but Bailey's investigation remains unfinished. That, however, may soon change. This week, a dozen and a half news outlets and organizations from around the Bay Area, from KQED Public Radio to the Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, have formed the Chauncey Bailey Project to continue reporting this story. Robert Rosenthal, formerly of the San Francisco Chronicle, is editorial coordinator of the project, and he joins me now. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
This collaboration is reminiscent of the Arizona Project, in which a number of journalists carried on the work of Don Bowles, who was assassinated 30 years ago investigating organized crime. Are you using that as, you know, the kind of model in forming the Bailey Project?
The genesis of this really came a few days after Mr. Bailey was assassinated, when Sandy Close of New American Media and Dory Maynard from the Maynard Institute got a group of Bay Area news organizations together to try and figure out how to continue not only Chauncey's work, but also figure out and look into why he may have been targeted. And I think the Bowles investigation in 1977 were certainly in everyone's minds who came to that meeting. I was not actually at that meeting, but I know that that's how this started.
Now, in that case, so the reporters essentially were finishing the story that Bowles had long since begun, and it was an extremely elaborate web of corruption and organized crime. Is that your goal here, to finally untangle exactly what Your Black Muslim Bakery is up to?
That's part of it. I think it's going beyond Bailey's work, I have to say. I think that when you look at the Bay organization over more than 20 years, they're really intertwined with so much of what's happened in Oakland.
Let me interrupt by saying you mentioned the Bay organization. You're referring to the founder of your black Muslim bakery, Yusuf Bey. Tell me about him and his history.
Well, Yusuf Bey broke off from national Muslim organizations in the 70s and really began an economic enterprise. The bakery was one element of that, and he was a controversial and in some quarters revered figure in Oakland and in the Bay Area. He passed away a few years ago, and at the end of his life, there were all kinds of allegations about abuse, pedophilia, and the fallout from his death is sort of what's fermenting right now. But I just want to say also that when Chauncey was killed, he was also looking into some other things, including police corruption in Oakland. And we're really, you know, looking at everything. And in some cases, the people working on the story, the journalists, are also doing their other jobs. So it's almost really a volunteer effort that's sort of morphing into a much more sophisticated model. And it's really only began, you know, about a month ago.
A lot of the groundwork has already been laid by a newspaper, an alt-weekly called the East Bay Express, 3 or 4 years back, in a two-part series on your Muslim bakery. And by the editor's own admission, the paper at that time was actually scared off the story. In fact, here's what Stephen Buell told us about a month ago.
We did consciously decide to abandon the story about a year after the publication of our original project. I was torn about that then, and I'm torn about that now because there was more to write, and we were basically intimidated into silence. I'll always regret that in some way.
In the event that the principals in this story, whether of your Muslim bakery or local Oakland officials or others, do attempt to intimidate your volunteers in the way that they apparently scared off the East Bay Express, you know, what are your plans?
We raised that issue very early on, that this was potentially a journalistic endeavor that might involve risk. And we all agreed that this would not deter us. You know, it's been on everyone's mind. In fact, you mentioned earlier that there are students working on this from not only the University of California, Berkeley Journalism School, but also San Francisco State. And we've been very careful about how we use them and not put them in situations that might put them at risk.
Have there been any efforts so far to push you away, to scare you off, to do anything untoward?
No, not that I'm aware of. Paul Cobb, the publisher of the Oakland Post, Chauncey's boss, has been threatened, but none of us in this group have yet, as far as I know.
I'm going to come back to the murder of Don Bowles, which led to the Arizona Project and many reporters getting together to carry on the late reporter's work. At that time, some news organizations signed on, but many pointedly declined on the grounds that the whole thing smacked of a crusade and that good journalism and crusading, they believed at the time, don't necessarily go hand in hand. But were there any such reservations in taking on the Chauncey Bailey Project?
No, I don't think we saw this as a crusade. I think that we saw this as an extremely unusual occurrence in this country where a journalist is clearly targeted and killed for their work. And we believe that when that happens, that his peers or her peers will rally to bring light and a lot of heat to the people responsible. And I think in part that's what we're looking to do here, to try and make clear to everybody that when a journalist is targeted and assassinated, that it's not only a criminal act, but it's one that really affects sort of the foundation potentially of how our democracy functions and the role of the press.
All right, Robert. Well, good luck in the project. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robert Rosenthal, former managing editor of the San Francisco Chronicle and former editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, is the editorial coordinator of the Chauncey Bailey Project.
So, investigative reporters still rake the mud, but less and less at the magazines that once welcomed them. Slate columnist Ron Rosenbaum says that's because the glossies increasingly sacrifice independence for access, specifically access to stars. And to prove his point, Rosenbaum has made examples of two articles. One was a July profile in Esquire of Angelina Jolie, in which she was virtually canonized by a writer Rosenbaum admires, Tom Junod. The other was a piece not published in GQ. GQ had commissioned political reporter Joshua Green to write about discord in Hillary Clinton's campaign, but then the editors killed it, claiming the piece had problems. Green charges that it was spiked because it would have jeopardized an upcoming profile of Bill Clinton. Ron Rosenbaum is here to talk about the scourge of the celebrity profile. Welcome back, Ron.
Thanks for having me on, Brooke.
So you've been on a one-man mission against the celebrity profile since June, when you wrote about the worst celebrity profile ever written. Can you explain what so distinguished that particular cover story in Esquire?
Well, to put it in context, I think I'm not the only one who's noticed the way magazines have given up basically their covers to celebrity PR people who dictate photographers. They dictate what reporters are allowed to report. If the profile is not fawning, that reporter's out on his ear as far as reporting on any other celebrities. And this particular profile of Angelina Jolie, which called her the best woman in the world, sort of epitomized the low point of fawning for access, the pretension of it, with all sorts of pseudo deep think about the nature of celebrity and how Angelina Jolie is really an underdog and she identifies with the underdog. You know, all this bootlicking. And what do they get for it? They get Angelina Jolie to pose naked with a sheet so they can put that on the cover. They get basically no information. The fraudulence of it finally, I don't know.
Pushed you over the edge?
I pushed me over the edge, yeah. I mean, there's a kind of trap in access. There's a Stockholm syndrome where the reporter, you know, feels too close to the subject. And then also politicians particularly, but most people with power have crafted their act so well that they will never really give away anything new or truthful.
And you offer a solution, the right around.
Well, let's separate the two articles I did. I wrote a piece on the worst celebrity profile ever written, and the most recent piece I did for Slate was about Clinton pressuring GQ to kill a story. And what we saw there was these Hollywood rules of access being applied to politics. GQ was willing to kill an investigative story so that they would have the illusion or delusion of an exclusive with Bill Clinton. Like, Bill Clinton hardly talks to anyone. And they would be able to put Bill Clinton on the cover of their world-renowned GQ Man of the Year issue and have it their exclusive photo rather than a stock photo. Like, Clinton's going to look so different and the readership is going to be convinced that there's some special intimacy. One of the most photographed people in the history of humanity.
So what is the right around?
The right around is a sort of term of art often used disdainfully. It means the subject or potential subject of a profile refuses access, refuses even the half hour carefully monitored by PR interview. What is done is to investigate the person from the outside. It's really, at its best, investigative journalism.
You say that this is really about politics and less about celebrities. On the other hand, an example you cite of one of the great write-arounds of all time was by Gay Talese and was about Frank Sinatra.
It was, in a unique way, about Frank Sinatra's power, as reflected by the many layers of flunkies and lackeys who surrounded him, who were the only people that Talese was allowed to talk to. And at least he painted a picture of what raw power is.
It was called Frank Sinatra Has a Cold.
Yes, and the many repercussions for the many layers of flunkies and lackeys that this cold had. You can learn more from an investigative reporter who doesn't speak to the person. I've called investigative reporters sociopaths for truth, because they're a different breed of cat. They're not afraid to hurt feelings if it means telling the truth about someone.
So if you were a magazine editor, how would you balance your desire for more investigative reporting with the market demand for Angelina Jolie wearing a sheet?
I suppose that's hard to compete with, but I think there's also respect for the reader. Magazines have turned themselves into slaves of the publicity industrial complex. And I think the best magazine stories are the ones that you would not have imagined existed until you read them. They find a way to show you why they're important rather than use some brand name to do so.
Ron, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Ron Rosenbaum is a columnist for Slate and author of The Shakespeare Wars.
We say it all the time, but we hardly ever think about it. Or those other filler words we use to stall because we're nervous or to cue the person we're talking to. Is rarely written in books. It's usually scrubbed from TV and not included in film scripts. But Michael Erard, who's written a book titled says the word has always been with us. This staticky clip is the earliest recording of a guy named Thomas Edison.
Now, Mr. Blaine, as you've been hearing around the world, Europe will go to Milan. Milan will go to Rome. And then to Bombay.
About the only word you can make out from this 1888 recording is the non-word, And Michael Erard says that isn't insignificant.
The father of recording technology, the first word that he says is a moment of pausing, of delay, because he doesn't know what to say next. Filling pauses with those particular sounds in English happen about 40% of the time that we make errors, and we make errors about one every 4.4 seconds or one every 10 words.
And is this a universal phenomenon? You mentioned English. Does it happen in other languages? And do people say France?
Every language gives a speaker a way to fill a pause with a sound. Sometimes it's that neutral vowel. In English, it's In French, it's e. In Spanish, it's e. Other languages repurpose words that mean something else. So in Mandarin, the word for this and that is the word that you fill pauses with. So if you listen to Mandarin speakers, they'll say nega, nega, nega. Or in Japanese, it's ano, which also means this or that.
What about the public's patience for vagaries of spoken language? Is there, in fact, an ebb and flow to the way we all handle other people's speech errors?
We typically don't hear most of the uhs or the ums that other people say. There was one interesting study that was done where people are given a speech to listen to, and about half of them natively listen to the content, and about half of them natively, without any instruction, listen to the style. When the content, for whatever reason, becomes extremely boring, people who listen for content start listening for style. And that's when they start to notice uhs and the ums. So when people say to me, how do I reduce the uhs and the ums? I say, that's easy. Just be more interesting.
Now, you mentioned that we typically filter out other people's speech errors, but not every other people. When the people are prominent, we tend to pay very strict attention. I'm thinking at the moment of President Bush, who is a serial offender and disfluencies of various kinds.
Sure.
What happens when a major public figure like the President of the United States is so language challenged?
What happens, I think, depends on what your expectations for leadership are. If you expect your leaders to be able to articulate positions and to persuade the public to follow those positions, then you would expect your leaders to be fluent, to speak in longer sentences. On the other hand, if you expect your leaders to be more like you, you might be willing to tolerate more verbal blunders. And so I think that assuming that Bush and the way that he speaks is a political liability overlooks how that mode of speech is also attractive.
Actually, your colleague, Jeff Nunberg, believes that the president actually cultivates his rough-hewn language in order to cultivate the part of the electorate that appreciates it.
I suspect that that's true. Now, it would be very difficult for someone to deliberately create some of the malapropisms and some of the true accidents that happen. So misunderestimate.
They misunderestimated the fact that we love a neighbor in need. They underestimated the compassion of our country.
He's very disfluent when he says it. So he's aware as he's saying it that he's not quite hitting it and it should be different. But at a certain point, he just lets the momentum of the word and the need to keep going take over and he continues.
Let me ask you one more thing. I myself can barely utter an English sentence without making some sort of egregious error right in the middle of it.
We naturally edit all of this stuff out of the show, or most of it. Are we doing our listeners a service by editing out my mistakes and yours as well, by the way?
I think you might be doing them a disservice. We live in a media environment that is very glib, and the glib has become praised over what is substantial. You know, in journalism, there's a sort of understanding that you won't make someone sound more stupid or low class or uneducated than they actually are. Quoting verbatim can be used to smear someone. But I think there's also a way to use it in a way that gives you a more authentic sense of who the person is.
Well, Michael, I very much appreciate this.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Erard is the author of the new book, Slips, Stumbles, and Verbal Blunders, and What They Mean.
Coming up, director Brian De Palma charges that his new war film, Redacted, has been redacted.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Debate is already raging over Brian De Palma's new film, Redacted. He won the Best Director's Prize at the Venice Film Festival, but the early reviews have been decidedly mixed. The story is based on the rape and murder of a teenaged Iraqi girl in Samarra. The rest of her family was killed, too, by American soldiers last year. And in fact, as you will hear in the next few disturbing seconds, that rape scene plays like a horror flick. The soldiers are out-and-out psychopaths. The film pushes the limits, then goes right over the top.
Oh, you ready? You ready for the ride of your life, bitch? Shut the f*** up! Don't you f*** make a sound! Give it to her!
Redacted is ingeniously constructed. The narrative is conveyed through a soldier's video journal, TV news reports, insurgent website videos, surveillance camera footage, excerpts from a French documentary, YouTube clips, all fabricated but convincingly realistic. The one part that is not faked comes at the end. Photographs of actual dead, injured, or traumatized Iraqis. The eyes of the people in those photos are obscured. On Monday, at the Film Festival press conference, De Palma blamed that redaction on the film's financier, Mark Cuban. And that prompted a defense from the floor by Eamon Bowles, the president of Magnolia Pictures, who said that no one had signed releases for the pictures, and if anyone complained, the producers could be sued.
Listen, I really like the film. I appreciate it greatly. However, it is a legal issue. You cannot have
a specious legal issue.
It's not specious. There would be no legal recourse if someone put a case in. No legal recourse whatsoever.
The very last shot is not real. It's a gruesome imagining of the corpse of the young girl. De Palma told the Village Voice that he saw nothing wrong with distorting reality in pursuit of what he called a greater truth. We asked him why he thought his producers chose to obscure the real faces of the dead.
They, I think, hide behind legalities, stating that they would have to get more insurance because there's something that if a relative of one of the victims in the movie sees themselves or sees a victim from their family and gets extremely upset, they can sue you. I mean, it has never happened as far as I know in terms of war photographs. You don't get releases for war photographs. What I found unusual about the whole situation was that they had vetted everything in the script. They knew we were using real photographs. If this was always a problem, they could have told me and I could have recreated them. So I think somebody actually looked at the photos and got extremely upset and said, my God, we can't put this on the screen. Then they hid behind the insurance company.
The lines over the eyes of the Iraqis in those images are squiggles very similar to the ones at the very beginning of the film to show redaction. Did you design those bars, those squiggles?
No, I had nothing to do with it. I refused to have anything to do with that. I said, if you're going to redact these photographs, you do it so the world can see you eradicating the suffering faces on these people.
How are you getting along with Mark Cuban these days?
Well, Mark Cuban is a man that doesn't return phone calls.
If you can't get those black bars expunged, will you be staging your own photos or will you leave it as it is?
Well, it's too late now. The movie's been in festivals all over the world. And I find it kind of ironic. I mean, the fact that redacted is redacted, you know, there's something about it. Because the whole idea of this came from the fact that, you know, in Vietnam, we saw the photos. We saw our soldiers hurt and wounded. And we got very disturbed by those photos. And the genius of the architects of this war is that there are no photos.
Well, there are. They're all over the internet. You
yes,
have some of them
but
in your
not,
film.
They're not in the mainstream media. I can't get them on a big screen. And that always leads me. When I don't see something and I have to go find it on the internet, I say, well, why aren't we seeing any pictures like this? Why aren't we seeing those famous pictures from Vietnam of the, you know, baby running down a street naked, crying out?
I don't disagree with the larger point. We have dealt with the issue of the whitewashing of the impact of this war on the program. I guess the question is, if you're going to fabricate everything else, why mix the real pictures in and open up this can of worms?
I was forced to fabricate everything else because of our legalities. I can't use anything real because it's real. Doesn't that seem rather strange to you? You can put it on the radio. You can put it on your television stations. You can show it in your magazines, but I can't put it in a movie. Why is that?
Is it because of the difference in the genres that yours is a drama, a dramatization, and these are ostensibly news reports?
My dear, it's all entertainment. Don't for a second think it's really news.
Brian De Palma, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Brian De Palma is the director of Redacted. And while one could argue vigorously the idea that all news is entertainment, the best legal argument supporting his case is that entertainment can contribute to the public's understanding of the world. That, according to James Boyle, a professor at Duke University and author of Bound by Law, Tales from the Public Domain.
Mr. De Palma would actually have a very good claim to fair use, that these are pictures are being used as a matter of commentary or criticism, even within the context of a fictional movie. Obviously, it's one that depicts and comments on real events. The more serious claim is the claim that the relatives of the dead Iraqis who are pictured or the injured Iraqis themselves might claim that these pictures infringe on their rights of privacy. So imagine someone taking a picture of you through the shower window or taking a picture of one of your loved ones who's dead after an automobile accident. And it's true that the courts have protected a right of privacy in some of those situations. But normally it has to be, the normal test is this outrageous to an average person to use this? The other part of the test is this a matter of legitimate public interest? And if it's a matter of legitimate public interest, then that right generally does not apply.
So if somebody takes a picture of me in the shower through the window, I can assure you that is of absolutely no public interest. Therefore, I would have a good case. But if I were the victim of some terrible crime and a picture was caught of me that I didn't want in the newspaper or even in a dramatization of the event, my case would be less good.
That's exactly right. And the sort of really strong example would be something where the images of the dead or the injured are themselves the matter of public debate. So it's not just a matter of sort of prurient interest in looking at autopsy photographs, which has often been a subject of litigation, but it's actually something where the main commentary about the event demands these photos. And of course, there is a substantial amount of criticism of current coverage of the Iraq War that says that the stuff that appears in mainstream media is amazingly censored, self-censored, that is, by the people who are photographing and by the newspapers and by the TV stations, much more censored than, for example, the pictures of the Vietnam War. So to the extent that that is part of the public debate about the Iraq War, the claim that we're not seeing the true pain, the true suffering that's going on, both for Iraqis and American soldiers, then I think Mr. De Palma's claim would be, that's what I'm showing here. I'm showing that this is real, that these are real people who bleed, who are in pain, and I've put this in a fictional film precisely to make that point, to shock you and make you think, my God, it's not just fiction, it's reality.
I'm still puzzled about the kind of suit that De Palma's producers worry could be brought in this case. I mean, how would the plaintiffs, the victims or families of the victims in the photos, frame their argument?
People who would say that there is a cause of action here, that Mr. De Palma could be sued, would point out that the families of the astronauts on the Challenger space shuttle were able to prevent the disclosure of their audio tapes of their last seconds, or that President Kennedy's family was able to prevent the disclosure of the autopsy photographs of him.
These were huge news stories. Why were they protected?
Well, I think the argument was that hearing the pain and confusion and fear of people who were about to die adds nothing to the political debate.
But isn't that the point of these photographs in De Palma's case? Misery, fear, mayhem, horror, the very things that you say have been censored about this war? How can you, on the one hand, prevent that stuff on that basis and then permit it on the very same basis?
If the whole NPR thing doesn't work out, Brooke, you have a career as a lawyer. I would say that the answer there is that we knew that these people, that the astronauts in the space shuttle, we knew that they died. Obviously, it was an awful set of moments. I think the answer here is that the pain of the Iraqis has not been making it to our screens, has not been making it to our newspapers. I think the claim here Mr. De Palma is saying is this is actually a necessary political comment.
Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
James Boyle is a professor at Duke University and co-author of Bound by Law, a comic book about fair use and documentary film. Beginning of this year, we spoke with film historian Jack Shaheen, the author of Real Bad Arabs. That's real with two E's. Shaheen is the narrator of a new film version of the book, also called Real Bad Arabs, and it's packed with examples of Hollywood's most durable, demeaning stereotype. Take the 1994 Schwarzenegger action flick, True Lies.
One turn of that key, 2 million of your people will die instantly.
What key?
That key! Who's taken the key?
They simply act stupid. They are stupid. But at the same time, they threaten to kill us. So their stupidity has to be taken seriously.
Jack Shaheen says that True Lies marks another new low in the pernicious portrayal of Arabs across a century of American cinema. Back in the era of the silent film, Arabs weren't quite so dumb, but they were certainly dangerous.
Initially, it was always the Arab Bedouin out to go into the legionnaire's fort, slaughter each and every member of the legion, and then move to seduce the blonde, blue-eyed virgin, who, of course, was standing there with a pistol in her hand, ready to commit suicide in the event that a Bedouin bandit would, in fact, have the opportunity to seduce her, which, fortunately, he never did.
The image of the Bedouin and the dastardly sheik who commands him have endured in America's imagination forever. But now they're even more threatening, and not just on the big screen.
Now we are being projected in shows such as 24, Navy NCIS, The Unit, and others, dozens of others actually, as clones of Al-Qaeda and clones of Saddam, a threat to our country. Why project American citizens as a threat to their country?
Why, indeed? In recent times, a few Arab citizens of some European nations have given cause for alarm. There. But not here. So why, even long before 9/11, this Hollywood obsession? Habit, says Shaheen, and history. Do you think this extremist image finds its roots in the Munich Olympics?
Not only what happened in Munich, I think the Iranian Revolution had a part to play, even though Iranians are not Arabs. Most of us think they are. The Arab-Israeli conflict, the oil embargo. I think news headlines play a dominant role in terms of how we project and perceive a people. I also believe that, you know, we were taught to hate all things Arab for so many years, which helped make our going to Iraq that much easier.
Arab actors may not be happy with the image their characters project, but they frequently don't have a choice. You take the parts you get until you have enough clout to create your own. That's how Tony Shalhoub created Monk, the hit series about an obsessive-compulsive detective whose ethnicity is unknown and irrelevant. But somehow actor Seyed Bedreya, who has no clout, managed to produce and star in a signature short called T for Terrorist.
It's an actor that's tired of always being cast as the terrorist. So he gets cast as that again. He shows up on set and he actually hijacks the set. And he makes the director play the terrorist and he gets to play the good guy for once.
Do you guys really think I look like a terrorist?
Kinda.
I can do more than that. I can be the second Kelly Goober.
You mean Gary Cooper?
Whatever.
That was my story.
Seyed Bedreya.
Because I used to sit on the set and look at the movie star and the hero and everything. And I said, why not for one day I can be a hero? Why not for one day I can have the girl?
Bedreya was a kid growing up in Egypt in the time of the Six-Day War when he was seduced by American movies. When he said he was going Hollywood, his friends said he was crazy. But he did. He was a handsome Arab actor. In America, there were no parts for handsome Arab actors, so he grew a beard, put on some weight.
Then when I went to the audition, I was angry, and they said, oh, yeah, this is what we're looking for. This is the real thing.
Can you tell me about some of the bad guy roles that you played in the 80s and 90s?
Well, I hijacked an aeroplane in executive decision. I blew up places in True Lies. I kidnapped people. I done everything bad.
So he worked, though his parts found little favor in the Arab-American community. Then, not long ago, his friend Peter Farrelly, yes, of the infamous Farrelly brothers, told him it was time to produce something from his heart. So Bedreya made American East, a film about an Arab-American family man who opens up a restaurant with his best friend, who's Jewish. The friend is played by Tony Shalhoub. The goal, the depiction of ordinary men.
Kids. I don't want my kids to change his name from Muhammad to Michael because the Arab image is bad. No, I want him to have his name, Muhammad. And Muhammad doesn't mean terrorist. And that's what we bring in American East to talk about an Arab-American family who struggled after 9/11.
9/11 must figure into any discussion of Arab images in America. It should have made a bad situation worse, but in fact, it hasn't. Jack Shaheen says that maybe 90% of Arab images post 9/11 are still shallow and demeaning, but...
The encouraging news is there have been several post 9/11 films, Babel, Kingdom of Heaven, Syriana, where there have been portraits presenting Arabs as we see other people, no better, no worse.
Now it's time to refine the portraits of Arab Americans, says Seyed Bedreya.
Hollywood had to learn we are American. It happened to be Arab. We are American because we choose to come to this country. What is America? I grew up in a ghetto and I end up in Hollywood doing movie with movie star George Clooney and all this stuff. That's America. It gives you the dream, but you have to work for it.
Bedreya's new film, American East, has not yet found a distributor. The film version of Real Bad Arabs opens in New York City this week. Cannonball Run 2, hopefully, will never be seen again.
Here, my desert blossom. Give the change. Have you ever considered joining a harem?
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer, with help this week from Bill O'Neill. We also had help from Jessica Magaldi and Ian Whitehead. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.